Today's Veterans Radio is dedicated to all the men and women who have served or are currently serving in America's military. We thank you for your service because without your sacrifice, we would not be here today. Good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio on a beautiful Memorial Day weekend. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I'll be acting as sort of the coordinator today with Dwight Zimmerman's At Ease program. Joining me in the studio is my partner and co-founder of Veterans Radio, Bob Gould. Good morning, Bob.
Hello out there for everybody.
Mm-hmm. This is a great day, and
great
we're very
day.
Happy to be
Always
here.
Always like Memorial Day.
I know. And we want to remind everybody to make sure that you go out and celebrate, have those barbecues and everything else that go along, but take a moment every once in a while during this weekend and think about the men and women who have sacrificed to allow you to celebrate this day.
Get a flag,
go to the cemetery, and you're going to see all of the flags of all of the veterans from the Revolutionary War on. Just take a moment and pause and think about them.
You know, it's a nice, and going to a military cemetery is something that a family can do. They can bring flowers and just pick any grave, even if there isn't someone there that they know.
Yeah, and it's not maudlin to do that. I don't think. I mean, every time
not.
I go, it gets emotional because you think about the men, in my case, the men that you knew and that you served with and that have passed away, either during the conflict or since then, you know. There are a lot of old soldiers and sailors out there, and so we want to make sure that we celebrate them today. So I just wanted to kind of mention, I also want to welcome Dwight to the program. Dwight, good morning. How are you?
Hi there, Dale. Good morning, and thank you so much for talking to you from Studio 4F, Veterans Radio East in Brooklyn, New York.
Absolutely.
Where, unfortunately, we have, it's cold, windy, and rainy. In fact, the temperature is 20 degrees colder than normal.
Oh, cut it out. What do you want to go down to Jacksonville, right? Hey, we don't have any mosquitoes tonight, right?
Oh, you okay. Got that part right.
So if you got a jacket on, you can enjoy the hamburgers and hot dogs and not have all the bugs because it is a little cooler.
Yes.
I think it's a great opportunity for those of you out there that know a veteran. You know, this is a good day, a good weekend to get on the phone, give them a call, and just check in, see how they're doing, and thank them for their service.
Agreed. And when you were mentioning the visiting the military cemeteries, we've got an excellent one here in New York City, Cypress Hills National Cemetery, which has the second highest number of Medal of Honor recipients in it. At 18, next to Arlington.
Well,
sounds like a program.
Sounds like a program and something for people on the East Coast to do.
I didn't know that.
And I didn't either. And see, when you listen to Veterans Radio,
who knew that?
Of
New York City, right? I thought they only had pizza and Radio City Music Hall. And here, no, that's very.
I have to make a correction. I'm looking in my book about. Because I mentioned it in my book, Uncommon Valor. There's actually 24 recipients. Five of them are the double recipients, including Marine Sergeant Dan Daly. You know, he of the, what, do you want to live forever statement?
Well, that's great, you know, and most people don't realize, of course, that during the Revolutionary War, the Battle of Brooklyn was a major, major conflict there, and, you know, this was before the Dodgers were there and everybody. So, you know, I was talking to somebody earlier in the week, and we were talking about just the East Coast, and it was, you know, they were talking about the Jersey Shore, which is making a comeback, so all of you that are listening to us out there on the Jersey Shore.
What was wrong with it?
Well, we got a hurricane, you know. They had a grand...
You know, creatures coming.
Well, that was, yes, but we have they reopened part of Seaside Heights yesterday, and listening to the local news here in the Midwest, she said, you know, I really have to get out there, and, you know, I've never been out there. It's kind of like so far away. It's only 600 miles, you know, hop in your car, you can be there by dinner, right?
Yep.
Amen.
Anyway, I wanted to, again, just to remind people that that, you know, with Memorial Day weekend, that you do need to go out and honor these people and say thank you for the people that, that have the hats. We might be giving Dwight a call back, it sounds like. But I got a letter, email, and I'm sure all the other members of the American Legion got this also from the National Commander of the American Legion. This is Jim Coots. And I'm just going to read part of it because I think it's really appropriate here. And he says, all of us cherish the memories of our fallen comrades, friends, or loved ones. Not a day goes by when I don't think about the friends I've lost. I think about the young 20-somethings I knew from Vietnam who made the supreme sacrifice serving our nation. I think about the heroes from all the other eras, the Great Wars, Korea, Desert Storm, Iraq, and Afghanistan, who gave their lives so all of us could enjoy our freedoms. This weekend, of course, another Memorial Day is upon us. I hope that you will join me in remembering to honor not only veterans who were close to you, but also all of our veterans who gave their all. While the mass media often makes this weekend out to be about barbecues and department store sales, it's up to each one of us to remind our communities about the true meaning of this day. And just before the program, I looked this up, morbid curiosity, I guess, but there have been over 2,700,000 military servicemen and women who have died since the Revolutionary War, in all wars combined. That's 2 million people. What would their lives have been like?
Mm-hmm.
I always wonder about
maybe
this.
The cure for cancer might have
maybe,
been.
Maybe, maybe. Mm-hmm. But we got to remember those people today. It's the difference between today and Veterans Day is really an emotional day for a lot of veterans. So if you see a lot of veterans out there wearing their sunglasses, even in New York, where it's cold,
yeah,
that's why.
And
they
especially
are.
Get a flag. Get a. I noticed in my subdivision, there were only 6 of us out of 200.
Really,
that had flags, and that's I just think folks kind of forget about that.
Well, we got
like something
them.
That you. That's right, exactly.
Fly your flag today.
But I think I think something else too that sometimes folks don't know where to get a flag. Right, I know. You can go to certain department stores, et cetera, but I think you can go online, and they have all sorts of banners and flags, like different mm-hmm. models and things. I know I was in one major department store last week looking for a mount, put it on mm-hmm. the side of the house, and they didn't have that. This was a major home improvement mm-hmm. store. Is that what you'd call it? Right. Yeah, one of the depot stores.
Careful.
I didn't say
Careful.
The whole thing. Nope.
Go to your local family-owned hardware.
I know.
I think that you might have
better idea.
Those.
Yes.
I find them.
You know, and that would be something else. I think a lot of businesses, too. Remember how they had Gold Star Mothers, right? They had a Gold mm-hmm. Star. Why don't we have a veteran play card, something you can put in your window? This is the VOB, veteran-owned business.
There we go.
Hmm?
There we go. There's
Ooh.
A great idea.
Who could
There's
we,
an idea.
Well, a lot of great ideas. Well, who do we go to see about that?
I don't know, but we got to get to Dwight's program here.
Yes, indeed. We have a great program here. I got some very special guests that I'm very happy to have on board. We're going to lead with historian Rick Atkinson, who told his the latest and last book in his Liberation Trilogy, The Guns of At Last Light. Robert Edsel, whose groundbreaking bestseller, The Monuments Men, was a blockbuster story of the hunt for the world's greatest masterpieces, you know, to try and save them in World War II. And his new book, Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis, he tells the heroic efforts to save the priceless cultural patrimony of Italy from looting by the enemy and destruction in the war. And critically acclaimed best-selling author Lee Woodruff is going to be talking about the Bob Woodruff Foundation, which is a foundation that provides resources and support to injured service members, veterans, and their families. It's going to be a very exciting program, and I guess we will be introducing Rick right after the first break.
We shall be doing that. And so make sure, everybody, you pay attention, stay tuned, and we'll be right back on Veterans Radio with Dwight Zimmerman and his version of At Ease.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio with this month's version of At Ease with Dwight Zimmerman. And Dwight, you're on.
Thank you, Dale. Welcome, everyone, to this special Memorial Day edition of At Ease. And I'm proud and thrilled to welcome my first guest, best-selling author Rick Atkinson, who will be talking about his latest book, The Guns at Last Light. Rick, welcome.
Good morning, Dwight. Thanks for having me.
Oh, hey, thank you for being here. I finished your book last week, and I have to say, you wrote a monumental book right here. This was fun. I was absolutely, completely enthralled.
Well, thanks for that. I'm glad to have it done. As you mentioned, this is the third and final volume in something I call the Liberation Trilogy, and it's about the role of the American military and the liberation of Europe in World War II, and the first one was about North Africa, second one is about Sicily and Italy, and this one is about that long ultimate campaign from Normandy to the end of the war in Europe.
Yeah, so you started this whole project in 2002. Did you expect it to take more than 10 years to complete?
I actually started it in 99, so it's been the better part of 14 or 15 years. And no, I didn't expect it to take quite this long. I did, after the first volume was published in 2002, take a little break. I went off with Dave Petraeus and the 101st Airborne Division for the invasion of Iraq, and I wrote a little book about that experience. And I, after the second book was published in 2007, I went back to the Washington Post, where I had worked for a long time, and I went to Afghanistan and Iraq and wrote a long project about roadside bombs. So it did take me a bit longer, but on the other hand, I took a couple of detours.
Yes. So tell our listeners a summary of the events here in Guns at Last Light, please.
Well, the book opens on May 15, 1944, at St. Paul's School on Hammersmith Road in London, where Eisenhower and Patton and Omar Bradley and Winston Churchill and King George VI and all of the senior commanders who are going to command Operation Overlord, the invasion of Normandy, have gathered to review the plan for the last time. It's an extraordinary scene, having all these people in one room. It was called the Model Room. They had an immense floor map of where the River Seine empties into the Atlantic Ocean, and they went over beach by beach, basically precisely what was going to unfold on what in 3 weeks would be the most famous battlefield in the world. And the rest of the book unspools from there. We go through the campaigns in Normandy and to places like Mortain and Falaise and the liberation of Paris, Aachen, the Hurricane Forest, the Battle of the Bulge, the crossing of the Rhine, the encirclement of the Ruhr, and finally across Germany to VE Day, May 8, 1945. I also spend a lot of time in southern France. Most Americans don't know a lot about that campaign. We, along with the French army, invaded through the area around Saint-Tropez on August 15, 1944. Fascinating characters, fascinating campaign up the Rhone River Valley through the Vosges Mountains in the winter, and they capture Strasbourg. So they are on the Rhine in November 1944, 4 months before any of the other Western allies reached the Rhine. So I spend a lot of time with that campaign and those remarkable commanders.
Yes, I'm glad that you did, because as you point out, that was primarily an overlooked aspect of the campaign, that we, for the most part, it was just the landings at Dragoon, and then next thing we know, they're up, have linked up with Eisenhower's armies, you know, Patton's Third Army, and, you know, bang. So I'm glad that you spent as much time as you did with that, because I learned an awful lot of stuff right there, particularly the problems that they had with the French. We think it was just de Gaulle, but no, there was major problems on the southern side, too.
Well, it was a challenge always working with allies, and the French First Army commander is an extraordinary character, a general named Jean de Lattes de Tassigny, and he's beyond the powers of any novelist to invent. He's really an extraordinary combat leader, but he's a difficult character, and the senior American commander, again, someone most Americans know nothing about now, Jake Devers. He's commanding one of three army groups in Europe, one of the largest units to participate in the liberation of Europe, Jake Devers is. And he's got a great gift for dealing with allies, in his case, the fractious French, in the same way that Eisenhower is also gifted at dealing with allies, mostly the British in Eisenhower's case. So, I think it's important. I think it's important for people to know that the war in Europe remains awful to the very end. There were more than 10,000 American soldiers killed in Germany in April 1945. That's the last full month of the war in Europe. So you can see that's almost as many as died in June 1944, the month of invasion. It's awful, virtually to the last gunshot.
Yes. Now, you have a website, correct?
Yes, www. Liberation Trilogy, one word, liberationtrilogy.com, and there are lots of photos, including all the photos that are in the books, terrific maps by my cartographer, Gene Thorpe, who's done 69 maps for the three books in the trilogy, and many other things on liberationtrilogy.com.
Rick, another thing that impressed me, too, was how you analyzed the paradox of the maturation and disintegration of the alliance, you know, the closer that we got to victory.
Well, it's true. There are centrifugal forces that beset every alliance, every coalition, whether it's in World War II or World War I or today. And one of the challenges for a commander of any coalition is to try to figure out how to overcome all of the centrifugal forces that do beset it, and that ranges from personal vainglory to national parochialism. And certainly for General Eisenhower, who's the supreme commander in Europe, trying to deal with the British, with especially Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery, who can be a very, very difficult subordinate, and trying to deal with the British generally, and Churchill, and the recognition by the British High Command that, in fact, the empire is imperiled, that World War II is going to sweep away the old constructs, that there will be a new world, really, coming out of the war. There will be two superpowers. That's a neologism that was coined in 1944, and there are going to be two of them. One's the Soviet Union, the other's the United States. And that doesn't leave much room for the British Empire, the French Empire, and some of those other colonial constructs that had existed for centuries. And so all of this is very fraught, even as you're fighting a war in common cause trying to defeat the Germans.
And then on top of that, in the final weeks of the war, Franklin Roosevelt, our president, passed away, creating a whole new dynamic with incoming President Harry Truman.
Well, that's true. April 12, 1945, Roosevelt had a cerebral hemorrhage and died at Warm Springs, Georgia. I found, among many things that I found that are unique and new in this book, I believe, the five-page detailed account that the coroner wrote, the coroner from Atlanta who had been summoned to take care of Roosevelt's body after the president died. It's very clinical, and it's very moving. It's an extraordinary document of preparing the president for eternity, essentially. The president's death was shocking to everyone, even though for months he had looked deathly, frankly. For young soldiers, He was essentially the only president they'd ever known. He'd been in office for he was in the beginning of his fourth term. As commander-in-chief, he had been the father figure to the nation for a long time, and all of a sudden he's succeeded by someone virtually no one knows, a rather obscure senator, now vice president from Missouri, a guy who had served as an artilleryman in World War One, Harry Truman. And all of this, as the war is coming to a close, as all of the difficult decisions have to be made about how the occupation of Europe is going to play out, and, of course, how to finish the war in the Pacific, how to defeat Japan, and ultimately the decision about whether or not to use the atomic bomb. All of this comes to play in those last few months of the war.
Yes, and for Truman especially, Roosevelt kept him in the dark about virtually everything, most importantly, the Manhattan Project.
That's true. Truman came into office on April 12th, 45, the moment the president died effectively, and was really quite unprepared. He knew very little about a lot of things, including the Manhattan Project, and had to come up to speed quickly and to make some extraordinary decisions. He didn't have a lot of time to think about it or study it. He had the good fortune, I think, to have a good bank of advisors, particularly military advisors, men like George Marshall. Marshall, of course, had been in the war. He'd been chief of staff since the day the war began, September 1939. He worked very well with Franklin Roosevelt. He was extraordinarily experienced, a selfless man of great probity. And, of course, Roosevelt knew, or Marshall knew everything about everything. And I think that Truman was fortunate in having that strong shoulder to lean on.
Yes, and I agree. We're coming to close here. What's your next project?
Well, we announced yesterday, in fact, in New York, or Thursday, I guess it was, that I'm going to leave World War II behind. 15 years is long enough on anything. I'm not shifting to the Pacific. Instead, I've agreed to take on a trilogy about the American Revolution. I'm trying to do the same thing, looking from both the foxhole tactical view up to operational strategic views of our first war, and in some ways our most important war. It's the existential crisis to defeat all other existential crises, and the characters are fantastic. They're really compelling, whether they're American, the guys you know, or whether they're British, who are especially interesting, French, German. So I'll start working on that in earnest. I've been at it for about a year now, and that's what I will do for the next decade or so.
Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that when it comes out and have you as a guest on our show. So I've been talking with Rick Atkinson, who has been discussing his concluding book in the Liberation Trilogy, The Guns at Last Light, which is available at bookstores everywhere and on his website, liberationtrilogy.com. Thank you, Rick, and good luck.
Thanks so much, Dwight. Good to be with you.
So, well, Dale, we have our next guest on board, I take it, Robert Edsel, correct?
Absolutely. He's there.
Okay. Robert, welcome to At Ease.
Good morning.
Yes, and I have to tell you that I was just so enthralled by your book, Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. Yes, I knew in general, of course, about Nazi efforts to basically be the vacuum cleaners of their conquered countries, and they made Napoleon look like a piker. This is just absolutely amazing what the extent that they went on.
It's an incredible story. I mean, you consider all the museums in Europe closed for a period of 5 years, millions of cultural objects and the most famous paintings and sculpture being moved around over bomb-cratered roads outside the cities to try and protect them from bombing, the initial concern, Allied bombing, and the consequent fires, and then looting on a scale, as you point out, we've never seen before. The the Nazis having methods of transportation with trains and planes that Napoleon could only have dreamed of, and it introduced a new kind of soldier to World War II. These officers known as the Monuments Men, men and women, museum directors, curators, art historians, and artists, middle age, who'd volunteered for military service to be a new kind of soldier, one charged with saving, not destroying.
Yes. Now, one of the things that was fascinating was this, you know, invaluable fresco that got damaged in, it was Pisa, correct?
Well, Pisa, probably the most important painting in the world that was nearly damaged was the fresco of the Last Supper by Leonardo da Vinci in Milan.
That's
which
right.
Is how I begin the book.
It came within a couple hundred feet of being destroyed.
Less than that, maybe 88 feet by my calculation. A British bomb dropped in Milan as part of the Allied effort to force the Italians to change allegiance in August 1943. Really, no consideration given to applying the British technology of bombing at that time, which was being used against Germany, the firebombing taking place at night. No discussion about whether or not it was moral to use that same type bombing on the Italians in August 1943, after Mussolini had already left office, disappeared, really. And the decision was made to bomb the northern industrial cities of Italy to try and force their hand. Winston Churchill, having expressed out of frustration, we're going to give the Italians all manners of hell. And the bombs took place August 16th and 17th. It was firebombing, aiming at the center of the city, the cultural center of the city. And one bomb landed in the courtyard of the church, San Maria della Grazia, where the painting by Leonardo exists on the north wall of a dining hall. And it landed in the courtyard. It obliterated the east wall of the dining hall. The roof collapsed. And had it not been for the protective efforts of the Italian officials, anticipating that something like this could have happened, the Last Supper would be rubble, and we'd know about it from art history books. It would be gone. As it was exposed to the elements for some time before temporary roof could be built to protect it until the monuments officers arrived.
Yes, I remember reading a line in your book here about the German supreme commander in Italy, you know, commenting he never expected to be, I'm paraphrasing, never expected to be fighting, you know, in the middle of a museum.
Well, in fact, General Mark Clark, general of U.S. Fifth Army, made the same comment. Everyone expressed frustration in Italy that no matter which direction you turned, you had important, whether it was churches, buildings, monuments, or works of art, and it really was like fighting a war inside a museum, and it created all sorts of problems for both sides.
Yes. How did you get started in this project?
Well, this is my third book. I heard you interviewed Rick, who's a good friend and has written an extraordinary final conclusion to his trilogy series. This is my third book on the subject of the Monuments Men that began almost 16 years ago. I was living in Florence in 1996 and walked across the Ponte Vecchio Bridge and wondered, how is it that in the face of the most destructive conflict in history, the loss of some 65 million lives, so many of the works of art and cultural treasures of Europe did survive World War II? And who were the people that saved them? And I didn't know the answer. I started asking people that lived in Florence, and they all said, wow, that's an amazing question. What's the answer? And I said, well, I don't know the answer. I'm embarrassed that I've never thought of it. And over the course of time, you know, I realized that this remarkable period of history really has just been hidden in front of all of us because it was all put back so close to how it looked before. We don't think about it, but all the bridges in Florence blown by the Nazis before they fled the city in August 1944, with the exception of the Ponte Vecchio, the majority of the works of art from the great Florentine museums, the Uffizi and Pitti Palace, taken by Nazi forces as they fled north, important works from Pompeii and the museums in Naples, deliberately stolen by the Hermann Göring Tank Division as a birthday gift for their leader. So extraordinary moments in history that so many of these great cultural treasures we enjoy today were at peril and risk of being destroyed. And it, as I say, this great group known as the Monuments Men and Women, acting on a historic directive from General Eisenhower that said it was the responsibility of all troops to protect cultural treasures so much as war allowed, were able to get in and not only effect temporary repairs to damages, but also be art detectives in tracking down what I refer to as the greatest treasure hunt in history.
Yes, we are approaching our break, Robert. So I am talking with Robert M. Edsel on his fascinating book, Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. And we'll be back with talking with Robert about this book right after our break.
The Medal of Combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Deming Bronson was struck by an exploding enemy hand grenade, receiving deep cuts on his face and the back of his head, but continued to lead his men. Details after this.
There's always a moment of truth where I say, look, it's either put up or shut up. And it was time to put up. I had crossed that thin line. It was 100 plus degrees. We were hot. We were on fire. We were yelling our hearts out. You could feel the intensity rising. Even in our tiredness, even in our weakness, even in our pain, we continued to push. I told myself, you can suck up the pain for another mile and a half, and you will be a Marine. Not many people believe that I could do it. I don't know where I got the energy from. I don't know where the pain went to. But all I know is that I had what it took. I am a United States Marine.
AFC Darrell Willis proved he could be one of us. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
Bronson, although injured, participated in the action that resulted in the capture of an enemy dugout with a great number of prisoners. On the afternoon of the same day, he was painfully wounded in the left arm by an enemy rifle bullet. And after receiving first aid treatment, he was directed to the rear. Disregarding these instructions, Bronson remained on duty with his company throughout the night, although suffering from severe pain and shock. The next morning, his regiment resumed its attack. Bronson's company was left in support of the attacking line. In spite of his wounds, he joined in the capture of the village. After the capture, he remained and participated in the capture of an enemy machine gun, he himself killing the enemy gunner. Shortly after this encounter, the company was forced to retire due to the heavy enemy artillery barrage. Bronson, who was the last man to leave the advanced position, was again wounded in both arms by an enemy high-explosive shell. He was then assisted to cover by another officer who applied first aid. Although bleeding profusely and faint from the loss of blood, Bronson remained with the survivors of the company throughout the night of the second day, refusing to go to the rear for treatment. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and you are listening to Veterans Radio this beautiful Saturday morning on WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And now back to Dwight Zimmerman and At Ease.
Thank you, Dale. I'm talking to my guest, Robert Edsel, about his book, Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. And, Robert, you have a website for this, the Monuments Men Project.
Well, this is savingitaly.com. Listeners can go and see photographs and drawings. In fact, one of these monuments officers was a great artist, Dean Keller, who sent home drawings to his three-year-old boy that he wouldn't see for 3 years. He was an older father. He didn't have his son, Dino, until he was 39. But it's a wonderful effort, as we near Father's Day, to see how this soldier in the middle of combat was still trying to be a dad to his son, long distance, knowing he couldn't read, sending him drawings of what it was like during his experience. And we have maps and other things that we just couldn't fit into the book, important documents. And people can go to monumentsmenfoundation.org and learn about the role of the Monuments Men Foundation, 2000 recipient of the National Humanities Medal, for our work trying to preserve these heroes' legacy.
And they can get the book at that site as well?
The book's available at every airport bookstore, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores. Saving Italy and, of course, Monuments Men, my last book, which George Clooney's in the process of making into a film that'll be out in December that stars Cate Blanchett, Matt Damon, John Goodman, Hugh Bonneville, a remarkable cast he's assembled to tell the story of the Monuments Men in Northern Europe.
Congratulations. That's great news.
Well, it's very exciting. I mean, it's been my desire to see people around the world, not just Americans, know about the gold standard that was set during World War II by President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill with the authorization of General Eisenhower, that the United States and Great Britain set the standard for protection of cultural treasures during times of conflict. And it's a great moment of our history we should be proud of and know.
Yes, I agree. And now, one thing about, I noticed at the end of Saving Italy, you have a list of looted pieces that are still missing. Tell us about that, please.
Well, there's still hundreds of thousands of works of art and cultural treasures missing from World War II. Many were picked up by displaced persons, soldiers of all sides, including Americans, oftentimes as souvenirs. We've worked through the Monuments Men Foundation with a half dozen veterans and their families who were in Berchtesgaden and took things from Hitler's home, the Berghof. We've worked with soldiers that have picked up books and important things that belong to different countries, just, you know, wanting to remember the fact that they were lucky and made it home, and they lost a lot of buddies along the way. And, you know, now's a chance for these families to – these objects can't be sold. They're cultural property. There's laws against those things. And so we work with families to demonstrate this magnanimous thing called an American, that in the late part of their lives they want to work with the Monuments Men Foundation to get these things back where they belong. In some cases, it's been our National Archives. So it's been a wonderful part of the work that we're doing. At the end of Saving Italy, we list, including photographs, 10 of the most famous works of art that are still missing from Italy, taken during the war. And, you know, the search continues for these things. There are other objects like this, thousands that are still missing from Italy. Many of the hundreds of thousands are more in the northern part of Europe, from France, from Belgium, from Germany, other countries. Of course, many of them are in the eastern countries. But the search goes on today, and I think many of these things are going to surface. It's an exciting time to understand this story.
I agree. And Robert, we're going to have you back as a guest when the movie comes out. We have to go to my next guest right now. But, Robert, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on At Ease, talking about your book, Saving Italy. It's a fascinating book, and good luck.
Thank you. Great honor to be with you.
Thank you. Okay, we are coming up with our third guest now, Lee Woodruff. Lee, are you on there?
I'm here. How are you, Dwight?
Oh, I'm doing wonderfully. Yourself?
I'm doing great. Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Yes, yes, and to you. Everyone, I met Lee at this wonderful event down in Fort Lauderdale. The Broward County Public Library Foundation does an annual literary festival, and I was one of 20 authors invited down to, you know, help them celebrate. It's a big fundraiser, and that's where I met Lee and a bunch of other great authors. And we had a great time.
We really did. It was an action-packed weekend, and Dwight and I bonded over the issue of veterans and you know, how we care for them when they return home. We had a couple of great discussions over a couple of glasses of wine, as I recall.
Yes, indeed. So anyway, yes, Lee Woodruff, you know, you're a critically acclaimed best-selling author, but you also are you know, helped found a foundation. Give us some background of this foundation and you know, the events that led up to it.
Well, I'm married to a guy named Bob Woodruff, who's a journalist, and in 2006, after Peter Jennings passed away from lung cancer, Bob was appointed the co-anchor of World News, and about 6 weeks after that, he was in Iraq reporting on the war. It was the President Bush's State of the Union address that in that instance. He'd been to Iraq eight other times, and he'd been embedded in 2003 with the military. So he was, you know, he was really a war correspondent and had covered numerous conflicts over the past decade. And this was supposed to be a simple mission, just to sort of see how the troops were doing and how the handover was going at the time in 2006. And what happened to Bob is what happened to our troops every day. It was a roadside bomb. He was critically wounded, in a coma for 5 weeks, and it was a very scary time, as so many military families understand. He's ended up with an incredible recovery. We wrote a book called In an Instant, A Family's Journey of Love and Healing, which is really the story of it's really a story of a marriage. It's a love story, but it's also a very familiar story to anyone who's had a loved one injured in war or in conflict. And our healing and recovery was so exceptional, and the folks that we saw around us at Bethesda Naval Hospital, and the journeys that many of our military families have to make with far less resources than we had, and without the power of ABC News to kind of give unlimited rehab and so forth, really galvanized us to create the Bob Woodruff Foundation. And the mission of that foundation is to help returning veterans and their families from these recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan get back on their feet, get back to a working world, get the services they need, and help with issues like post-traumatic stress and combat stress.
Yes. Where can people get that book?
Well, I guess wherever books are sold. I always try to encourage people to go to their local bookstores, because they are disappearing and we need to support them. But I know the book's online as well, and it's in audiobook and all digital and all the other ways people read. It's just In an Instant by Lee and Bob Woodruff, and it really goes back and forth between Bob and my story from our two voices and points of view.
Okay. We are approaching our break right now, and so just stay with me. And I've been talking to my guest, Lee Woodruff, who is discussing and explaining the Bob Woodruff Foundation. So, Dale, take it away, and we'll be back in just a moment.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back here on Veterans Radio with Dwight Zimmerman and his program At Ease and his guest Lee Woodruff. Dwight, you're on.
Thank you, Dale. Yes, I'm talking with Lee Woodruff, a critically acclaimed best-selling author, and who is discussing the Bob Woodruff Foundation, which is a foundation that provides resources and support to injured service members, veterans, and their families. Lee, you have a website for this foundation, correct?
I do. You can just go to bobwoodrufffoundation.org. So Woodruff has two Fs. It's W-O-O-D-R-U-F-F. Bob Woodruff Foundation. It's a mouthful. But we've toyed around with a lot of different sort of marketing slogans. And the honest truth is, I think a lot of people remember and associate Bob's injuries with what we're doing. So that's the way to find out. We really, there are so many incredible organizations, Dwight, and I know you know this. There are more than 40,000 501c3s, nonprofit organizations out there helping veterans. So it's a real maze of trying to navigate. Some are truly better than others. Some are doing real work. Some have, you know, higher overheads. And I think anybody that gives in the veteran space really needs to take a look at the financials before you decide. I get asked all the time, what are good organizations to give to? So Bob and I realized that as the needs of the wars and the veterans coming back from these wars change and transition. 6 years ago, it was good rehab. It was, you know, help beyond to help retrofit a house. A lot of basic issues. And in that time, the VA and, you know, the federal government has been able to really pull its game up. We were very unprepared for these kinds of head injuries and the great numbers that we're seeing. But the issues change as the war morphs. And as you know, this is the war that's dragged on the longest. We're in year 11 now. I was with Admiral Mike Mullen, the former Joint Chief of Staff, this week, and he was saying, you know, this is the longest war we've ever had. And so we've gone from rehab needs to needs morphing all the way through now to needs for not just reintegration, but really reemployment and suicide prevention. So Bob and I think wisely, and I can't say we had any great knowledge, but I think we stumbled on it, decided that we would be, rather than a bricks and mortar organization, we would use our voices and our story to raise money and then turn around and give grants to small grassroots organizations on the ground that are really helping veterans in these areas as their needs, you know, mutate a little bit. And so a big part of what we do is act sort of like a united way. We have a small, tiny staff, but we use our manpower to really vet a lot of the groups out there, who's doing what, create dollars that can give them programs, stay involved with their business models, and make sure they're doing what they say they're going to do.
Yes, one of them being this organization called Remind. Tell us about that, please.
You know, this is confusing. Remind is us. Remind.org is BobWoodrufFoundation.org. But what we've realized after 5 years of using the Remind slogan, it was originally conceived to remind people that there are folks out there serving, remind Americans that veterans are home. And then, of course, the play on words was mind, because brain injuries, traumatic brain injury, is the signature injury of these wars. But what we realized is people are confused about the difference between Remind and Bob Woodruff Foundation. So we're transitioning back. If you go to remind.org, it will shoot you to the BobWoodruffFoundation.org website, and that transition just happened this week. All too much detail for you and way too boring, but they are literally one and the same thing, but we're going to try to move away from Remind because it doesn't really tell people what we do and who we are.
Okay, yes, I can see where the confusion would arise, but I'm on the website now, and it's just fascinating. You've got a wide range of, you know, things. I've just been really impressed.
Well, you know, we've been around now 6 years. We've given away over $15 million. The veterans' causes. We're very proud of the work we do, and I think people say, well, why give to a granting organization? And I think the reason is it's really hard for you to understand where your dollars are going. So when you give to us, you can know that we are personally involved in these grants and stay involved with the grantees. You have to run through a gauntlet of things before we even invite you to apply for a grant with us. And we have a really illustrious team of advisors that help us with our ears and eyes on the ground.
Yes, well, that's absolutely amazing, that much money in such a short period of time. It's, you know, great support. And I see that you've had a lot of major actors, actresses, musical, you know, people. I mean, this is a star-studded lineup.
We do an event each year, Dwight, and this year it will be November 6th, so people can hop on the website and find out more. But the event is really our biggest fundraiser, and we have incredible names of generous folks in the art world, or in the music and entertainment world: Bruce Springsteen, Jerry Seinfeld, Jon Stewart, Ricky Gervais, Roger Waters, who's very involved with veterans' causes, the Pink Floyd, Roger Waters, and they come every year and donate their time and talent to play for the crowd, who pays money at all different ranges to sit there. But the most important part of the event are the 100 veterans and their spouses that we, or parents, that we fly in for the event who get the front rows of the seat. And everybody comes because they can, you know, get a ticket and see Bruce Springsteen for $200. But they leave after that night being so touched by the service members that they've had a chance to intersect with.
Now, this is the Stand Up for Heroes event.
That's right. And that will be November 6th in New York City.
Oh, great. And in my neck of the woods, I'm going to try and make sure that I get there.
Good, good. You better get to me so I can get you that early invitation out, my friend.
Okay. By the way, how is Bob doing nowadays?
He's great. Was someone just trying to get your attention?
I was trying to jump in.
Okay.
Hi, Lee. This is Dale Thronberry with Veterans Radio. You said this is November 6th in New York City?
Yes.
I think that it needs to be covered by a well-known Veterans Radio program.
Well, I think you need to email me, too. Let's get you on the media list. How about that?
I think that sounds like a great idea. And thank you. It sounds like this organization is just what people have been looking for. This is something that we've talked about here on Veterans Radio, setting up some sort of foundation to distribute funds to other organizations that could help people out. And
it's a big job to figure out what those organizations are and who's doing it well. And,
correct.
You know, I think part of the big struggle that we've learned is it's real easy for people to say, oh, I want to help. I have a, you know, horse barn, so I want to start giving rides to veterans. But really one of the issues and one of the things we look for when we look to give grants is, number one, is it a replicable program? Is it something someone's doing that we can then take the model and give it to other folks around the country? And number two, is it really happening in areas where veterans live? Because veterans don't typically live in Manhattan, for example. They can't afford it. There are veterans in pockets all around the country, but not necessarily in big cities. And so are these groups just wanting to help, or are they really in places that are helping?
I think so many of them have, you know, their heart is in the right place, and they do want to help out as much as they can. But as you point out, the veteran community is spread out all over America, and we need to talk. We'll be contacting you.
Yeah, I would love that. That would be great.
I think what anything like this looks for is that organization. Who do I call? Where do I go? And that is what we are all doing, is providing that information so that there is a clearinghouse, a place for veterans to go, and non-veterans, where they can get this information.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we're having a lot of conversations lately, too, because I feel like at a certain point, as the quote-unquote sexiness of helping veterans wears down, and we all know it will, and it's already moving off the front pages, there's going to be a real issue in terms of giving fatigue or getting attention. And a lot of these organizations are all chasing the same donors. And so I think that there's going to need to be an aggregation and a combination of those of us helping. I mean, Bob and I would be thrilled if we could be put out of business if we didn't have to do this. We're not doing this for our ego. We're doing this because I think at a certain point in time in your life, sometimes you're tapped on the shoulder and someone says, this is your cause.
Absolutely.
You know, this is where you get to use your voice. And you got to listen to that.
Right. Well, we certainly understand that, Lee, and I want to thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Dwight. I'll let you finish your...
You interrupted, Dale.
It's so exciting when we find out, you know, that there are people out there doing these things and that we can't forget. You know, 11 years is a long time for a war to go on, and people, you know, normal civilians get, you know, mentally fatigued by the whole story. But
we've been covering that, by the way, because we've been in business for
ten years. And it, but it's one of those things that we feel that's our mission is to remind people of what veterans have done in the past and what they're going to be doing in the future, and to never forget.
Well, that's so important, and I think the other issue, too, as you two know intrinsically, is that you know, essentially with less than 1% of the population serving without a draft, most people out there don't know these veterans exist, don't see them, especially the Guard and Reserve who go back to not a base but their communities. And, you know, unless you're really tuned into what they've been doing, you're probably not tuned into helping them.
Okay, you know what, Dwight? You know, I'm going to have to interrupt here because we're going to be running out of time here.
Yes, that's true. But I thought we had a great program, Lee. I just want to thank you so much for being on the show and talking about your foundation. And I'll be in touch with you to get a ticket for the upcoming event.
That sounds great, and I loved that you guys had me on. It was a very special weekend. I'm honored that you had me on this incredible weekend to honor our veterans.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you, Dwight, very much. At ease. We'll be back at the end of June. And so we're looking forward to that. Coming up next week, Bob, you've got the program.
Yes, I do. I have Dr. Rebecca Grant back again. She'll be talking about drones.
Mm-hmm. Drones and what's going on with the Air Force and the changes in the legislation.
And we welcome your questions. You can talk to somebody who's an advisor to the Air Force. She knows everything.
The other thing in the next 10 seconds, go out and thank a veteran today for what they've done for you and for the community and for the country. The Veterans Radio is produced by Veterans Radio, LLC,
and
Veterans of America. All the views and opinions voiced today were not necessarily those of Veterans Radio or the program station that you are listening to. We'll be back next week. Until then, you are dismissed.